So, Stephen, thank you very much for joining us. You've sent out a whole lot of letters. One of them was to Health West, another to Matt Ducey, the Associate Minister of Health, Simeon Brown, the Minister of Health, the Professional Association for Transgender Health here in New Zealand. And you've done it all on behalf of Inflection Point. Who is Inflection Point and what's your purpose of sending all these letters?
The client is represented by an organiser who tells us that it's primarily families. They're probably conservative. I don't think it's a Christian front organisation. I think they're a fairly wide range of opinions from the sort of comments that have come into us from their supporters and the contributions. But they're people very concerned about this, about what they call elite opinion in positions of power, ignoring or even mocking and scoffing at the views of ordinary people, and in particular traditional views. And the reason that we expected that we would send the letters and that would be the end of it, they would then handle the inquiries in the media. But over the last several months, and indeed the response to our letters, have said that they just don't want to have to handle or to face the prospect of violence that could be threatened. I don't know if you went through any of the Reddit threads or the Twitter sequence that followed David Farrier's piece, but there are people there who want to cut off my arms, vomit on me, stuff saveloys up my nose. You know, there's a whole lot of, I don't know whether that's symbolic or not, but a lot of violent threats. And there's a genuine and I think justified concern that the police wouldn't take it seriously. They didn't look after Posy Parker. They let those women get beaten up in the Auckland demonstration. And the people who were intending to speak for Inflection Point asked us if we would just continue to front it.
So hold on, just hold up 1 second. These are threats that have been made to you?
Yes.
Have you made a police report?
No.
Because I noticed that there have been people that have made police reports and also claims to the to the law council about your actions here. You're not reciprocating in any way?
I haven't seen the complaints yet. I mean, if they're particularly ludicrous, I've got no objection to tit for tat. But with social media, a lot of these threats are anonymous. The police would say, oh, yeah, they won't take it serious. It takes a bit of process to get Facebook or any of these organisations to penetrate the anonymity of their platforms. And it's pretty par for the course. Someone like Annie O'Brien has been suffering this kind of threat for years and you just have to accept that these people are demented.
Have you considered going to the media to tell them about it? Because they like to run headlines about threats to people.
Not really. When I was an MP and we had threats, we didn't have social media then, but we used to get email threats. The settled wisdom was that you were better not to encourage them, that what they really wanted was to think they'd drawn blood or had you on the run or something. So one of the problems about complaining is just being a victim is a loser's game.
Okay, so there has been blowback to your letters. Do you know what the complaints to the police and to the Law Society are?
I've no idea what the police complaint is, but... And I've only read on social media and I think it was Radio New Zealand did a report of the Law Society one. I just had to laugh. The Law Society one allegedly has a line says something along the lines that he has been using the law for the advantage of his clients.
The police complaint also suggests that you've been using intimidation tactics on people and that's against the law.
No, well, it's not against the law. I'm pretty familiar with the law. I was a justice spokesman in Parliament for a political party for for two terms. So even though I'm a commercial and public lawyer, I'm pretty familiar with criminal law. Don't have the slightest concern.
Well, they also suggest that you're threatening these people and you're threatening them with legal action. That is evident, isn't it?
We're warning them. If we were threatening them, we'd be saying, we are going to sue you. What we're saying is you are at risk of being sued, whether it's us or someone else, or you are at risk of disciplinary proceedings, or you are at risk of being a star in one of the periodic scandals that emerge in health when people realise that what might have been common practice is unjustified and worse. I mean, there are many medical treatments that are harmful, but people have to take them because it's what the alternative is worse. What we've had here is a situation where for a long time, PATHA, the people who have been very keen on gender ideology and the idea that it's malleable and you can choose your gender, have been pushing it at young people for a long time without much organised evidence on whether there's net benefit. Whenever they've been challenged, they've said, if we don't do this, they'll suicide and that's worse. Well, now there's pretty solid evidence from three jurisdictions, essentially, that there is no evidence to support those claims and there is obvious harm from the treatments. And so they don't have a justification any longer for harmful treatment.
What jurisdictions are you talking about? You say three jurisdictions.
The UK, the CAS report is the biggest review of all the available evidence. And they also had a very noisy treatment community, I'll call them that, who just couldn't supply the evidence they'd always asserted there was, and who tried to stop the review from looking at their patient records and following up. So a fairly suspicious behaviour. Sweden, Norway, the Netherlands, there's been changes. Denmark, I understand, there's been changes in the practices in all of these areas where previously the fashionable thing had been was to say that playing with changing the sex of, or trying to change the sex characteristics of kids wasn't a harmful activity.
Could we just go back and explain exactly what we're talking about here? My understanding is that your letters are divided into, there's two basic parts here. There's the duty of care and informed consent, and then there's also puberty blockers. Would I be right in categorising it into those two groups?
Well, they're connected, but in the puberty blocker drugs, as I understand it, they're drugs that have been used for quite a long time for people treating prostate cancer. They suppress testosterone or the response to testosterone. And there are other drugs, all of which have significant effects on endocrine systems. Look, you're asking a lawyer about the medical stuff, and all I have is what we read to make sure that we were on a reasonable foundation in giving a warning. But because it hasn't been, it should have been the subject of substantial discussion in mainstream media. And I think you probably remember the agonised articles about the detriments of surgical mesh, and there's various other surgical procedures that have caused retrospective changes in practice over time. This is one where the reconsideration has been going for a couple of years now. The countries I mentioned have responded pretty decisively in restricting the use of puberty blockers on young people. And it doesn't mean that adults can't choose to have drugs if they want to that'll deepen their voice or help them grow a beard or other changes. But the focus of our clients was very much on children. And therefore, when we wrote, we kept it that focus pretty tight. That we're saying these kids are too young to make an informed decision. They're going through puberty, and they have all, pretty much all teenagers have periods of angst about who they are and how they can cope. And there's been various ways that it emerges. I understand that one of the consequences or one of the associations of this transgender mania, there's a significant reduction in anorexia being reported. So people are, young people may be substituting one medicalization of their angst with another.
Okay. But recently, if we're talking about puberty blockers, the Ministry of Health have updated their evidence on puberty blockers. I'm just going to quote from that for a moment. They say the ministry's assessment is that the starting point for treatment is a holistic assessment determining the full spectrum of needs a young person may have, including social and mental health. The precautionary approach signals the need for clinicians to exercise caution in prescribing, including that prescribing should only be initiated by clinicians who are experienced in providing gender-affirming care and are part of an interprofessional team offering a full range of supports to young people presenting with gender identity issues. When this was reported in a RNZ report, they quoted a couple of doctors. One of them was Dr. Massimo Giola, and he said that the ministry's position was reasonable and it would not change the way he practiced. In addition, they quoted Auckland University pediatric endocrinologist Professor Paul Hoffman. He said the ministry had appropriately concluded there was a lack of good quality evidence, but he stressed the evidence that was available indicated the use of puberty blockers was safe. It feels like there's a consensus. Everyone agrees that there's a good reason for this precautionary approach, and that's the way that they're approaching it. What's the need for your letters?
Then they've got nothing to worry about, have they? If they are acting appropriately, having dealt with the fact that the CAS review conclusions or the actions of governments on reliance on that is significantly different, they've got nothing to worry about. We drew the attention to something that appeared to be ignored in New Zealand, both in the mainstream media and, as far as we could tell, in medical literature. It's a little bit of a surprise that they say that it's safe and that they refer to all of those elements. The very name that's been adopted in New Zealand for this type of care, gender-affirming care, is political, ideological. When you affirm something, you are taking the situation and confirming it as it was first told to you. One of the problems that their own client reports to us is that a number of these practitioners are identified in social media as essentially being the no questions asked suppliers. Now, we have not attempted to identify those in particular. We've written to everyone who was identified to us with evidence as offering gender-affirming care, but the very name to me rings a big warning bell. You could say gender transition care or gender psychotic treatments or psychosis or sickness or whatever it is, but affirming says they've already decided that what you tell me, yeah, dysphoria, any word to try and avoid saying something that people will understand to be bad, but they could have done that. But the background reading we've done suggests we're dealing with an ideology here, not a carefully weighed set of medical judgments.